Hello, I'm Simon Burton and this is Arts Roundup, a new bi-weekly programme on Cambridge 105 FM radio, bringing you a selection of what's on in Cambridge by way of arts events and exploring the fascinating things creative people in the Cambridge community are doing. The series will involve everything from film, theatre, painting and sculpture, review the latest festivals and exhibitions, and in later editions look at the performing arts and music concerts. In this week's programme, I'll take a retrospective look at a major new festival for readers and writers, which is just drawing to a close, wrapped up today by the poet laureate Carol Ann Duffy, after thrilling the Cambridge arts community for more than 2 weeks. I'll also look at an exhibition of artist Bridget Riley's work with Kettle's Yard director Michael Harrison, and we'll hear about a new arts venue which needs to make ways to gain funding to expand. And then we'll move on to investigate a request for volunteers to make fine music at a local museum and get to grips with some of the more prestigious talent on display at Cambridge Contemporary Arts. Don't wait too long if you're thinking of becoming a writer. That's been the message for the past 2 weeks for the To the Lighthouse Festival for Readers and Writers, which centred on the works of Bloomsbury set writer Virginia Woolf. A backdrop of impressionist paintings by Gauguin, Picasso, Degas and many others, and Woolf's post-impressionist era sucked in literary fans for the launch at the Fitzwilliam Museum by Dame Gillian Beer and art historian Francis Spaulding. It was just the beginning of 16 events over 2 weeks, finishing today, and was designed to generate spontaneous new writing with a competition and to educate on Woolf's novels. At the Central Library, poet laureate Carol Ann Duffy is today presenting the Writing Challenge Prize to winner Amy O'Hanlon, an Ida Darwin student, and I'm told tears were shed by the judges over choosing the winning entry since so much good work was produced. Virginia Woolf is a definitive feminist writer, yet some people find it difficult to understand why this novel became such a life-changing addition to the canon of English literature. Here's Cambridge Professor Dame Gillian Beer, a former Booker Prize judge.
When I first read To the Lighthouse as an undergraduate, I could not make head or tail of it. And then I was asked to teach The Waves, which is the most difficult of them all, at a summer school in the United States. And it was really a very amateur group of people. And at first they were very resistant, and so was I. And then as we worked on it together, we all had a kind of conversion experience, because it's this intricacy with which she gives us access to other people's ideas, thoughts, feelings, desires. I think it's that. And also the extent to which it's just about ordinary life.
Now you gave a very interesting introductory speech and answered questions from the floor. Were you surprised at quite how many people wanted to delve into it and explore it as a subject?
I was. I mean, I thought it was a very good turnout. It was very much helped, of course, by Francis Spaulding coming in from a rather unusual direction and having done all the work on the Bloomsbury Group and being an art historian, so that she was able to set it in a context to do with how do you know things before you understand them, how do you look at shapes before you know what they mean, and so on. And I thought that was something that really stimulated people. We felt very glad that we'd had the setting of the Fitzwilliam Museum, which gave a whole extra new layer to any reading and thinking that we were able to do, because for people to go round, first of all, and look at specific pictures and have those in their mind as they approach the discussion of the novel, I think that was genuinely novel and special.
What started as just a spontaneous idea snowballed into a literary festival. The County Council's Literature Development Officer, Helen Taylor, captured the spirit of the festival.
I studied Virginia Woolf at college and absolutely hated it. And then I had a Road to Damascus experience rereading it and also talking to people. And I don't know, the book started to speak to me in a way that I thought could never happen. And then I started talking to other people about it, and I realised that Cambridge was full of people who were very influenced by Virginia Woolf. And then we just basically, you know, a bit like saying, oh, let's put on a show. Our target groups are from Cambridgeshire libraries, book groups from all over Cambridgeshire, just, you know, ordinary people. One of our events inspired by Wolf is using extracts from her diaries and from To the Lighthouse, where writers and poets will talk about how she's influenced their writing and why this piece of writing is so wonderful.
Have you had a look at entries to the writing contest?
We've judged it.
You've judged it. And what was the quality of the staff, Simon?
Two of us were in tears during the judging. The theme we had was A Space of My Own, which is a play on a room of one's own. And it was for 14 to 18 year olds. And it really seems to have touched a nerve.
Yeah.
And it was only 500 words. They only had 2 weeks to do it in.
Yeah.
It had to be signed off by a teacher as their original work.
Yeah.
But it was, some of them were so moving, and it gave you such an insight into that age group of young people, actually, where they do need a space. And it's, you know, it's not the computer game. It's not Facebook. It is a space. It could be like somebody was talking about going to school on the bus. That's their private space. That's when they relax, they think about the world, they have a relief from all the things that are worrying them. So it was totally illuminating, actually.
The Wolf phenomenon motivates people deeply in all sorts of ways, and even to write about her. Susan Sellers' award-winning novel about Virginia Woolf and her sister Vanessa Bell, an artist, has been adapted by Elizabeth Wright for the stage by Moving Stories Theatre under director Emma Gersh, and the highly successful run across Europe took the stage at Cambridge's Robinson College. It details the close and stormy relationship between Virginia Woolf and her sister and is told from Vanessa's viewpoint, starting after Virginia's death. Susan told me about her inspiration, which led to this bold and beautiful work. Now, the path of being a writer is not always an easy thing, really, is it? Because Virginia Woolf's life was absolutely fraught with dilemmas and crises, as well as the high spots. There were also low spots, and she was somebody who was a very controversial figure. So to actually take that path in life does take a lot of daring, doesn't it? And to reach into the inner depths and things like that.
Absolutely, and in fact, that was something that I really wanted to explore when I wrote a novel about Virginia Woolf and her sister Vanessa Bell. I wanted to explore some of the things that are not always fully documented from the available historical record, and explore some of the things suggested in her diaries and her notebooks about the creative process.
Now, that novel has won a lot of acclaim, and there's also now going to be a theatrical. There's a piece of theatre which has been successful in many places already. Which, can you tell me a little bit about the play too?
Yes, of course. That has been on tour in the UK. It's been to France and Poland and Germany. And it really is the story of Virginia Woolf and her sister Vanessa Bell, a very talented painter. And it follows the progress of that relationship really right throughout their lives, from the nursery right through until they were much older women.
Now not many people really, obviously someone as famous as Virginia Woolf, you don't actually realise that her sister was also an extremely talented artist, wasn't she?
Absolutely. She was a very, very talented artist. When she was, in 1901, when she was just 22, she was one of only a handful of students who was accepted for the painting school of the Royal Academy. And she studied under the influence of people like Whistler and Sargent, extremely talented artist. And she was somebody who was very brave in terms of her art. She really wanted to explore taking art outside the gallery, outside the frame, and she had a house at Charleston where she decorated every surface of it.
Now, Charleston House is a wonderful country house, isn't it? Now, I gather in the actual theatre production that's taking place at Robinson College, that what they've done is they've created a moving backdrop to the set, having photographed some of those paintings. How does that work?
That we were very lucky. We were given permission to take photographs of the artwork of Vanessa Bell from Charleston, and that's been put together as a moving collage, so that you see these animated artworks, and they continue throughout the play. There's also a live musical score which was specially composed for the production. So it really is about exploring all sorts of different art forms.
It's very interesting. interesting innovation and concept to do that, because what you're able to do is give mood to the drama that's taking across, but you're also delivering two messages at once, aren't you? Both sides of the story, the writer and her life, and then the actual, you're seeing the art from the sister as well. And I gather that a new actress has taken over in the lead role. Who's that?
That's correct, yes. Tomorrow, in fact, when the play opens in Cambridge, it will be with a new Virginia, and I'm very excited to see that. It's been absolutely fascinating to me as a writer to see the way that actors prepare themselves for these roles. And of course, they all bring different things to it, different life experiences, different bodies, different voices.
These can actually be previewed for this piece of theatre, can be previewed on YouTube already from previous productions. And it looks as though it's full of energy, it's full of life, it's a very interesting piece. How does it feel to be a writer to then see your work stood up like that and put into the spotlight?
When I got over the initial shock of seeing all the words scissored away, which of course is what has to happen, a novel of 80,000 words has to be reduced to 15. When I got over the shock of that and began seeing what it is that the production team do with the set design, the actors, it's extraordinary. It feels like a different thing from my novel, but it is absolutely spellbinding.
One of the world's leading abstract painters has opened an important new exhibition at Cambridge's Kettle's Yard Gallery. Artist Bridget Riley, who's just touching 80, celebrates the 50th anniversary of her famous black and white painting, The Movement in Squares, which created a fascinating optical illusion. The new show underpins a lengthy career devoted to exploring colour and our perception of its fleeting nature. The exhibition looks at four simple categories: colours, stripes, planes and curves. These may at first sound simple visual phenomenon, but you'd be really wrong to think so once in Riley's hands, because suddenly they become fantastically complicated. Riley was strongly influenced by a childhood spent in Cornwall looking at nature under her mother's appreciative eye, noticing water moving, pools in caves and the sea as light plays visual tricks, and that's the theme captured in the show. She was greatly influenced by a trip to Egypt in 1979, in which she made the discovery that was to change her artistic life, the palette of the ancient Egyptian artists. Kettle's Yard director Michael Harrison previews the work.
This exhibition really kicks off at a point where she had gone to Egypt in the winter of 1979-80, and quite unexpectedly she came across the colour of Egyptian painting that the Egyptians had used for 3,000 years. And here there was a fixed palette of colour. There was a blue, a turquoise, a yellow, a red, and black and white. And she came back and she created a palette which was very close to this Egyptian palette. And she used this to try to explore colours in relationship to each other, how one colour against another colour will be different from the same colour against a different colour. And the first works in this exhibition use these Egyptian colours.
Because we've got in front of us a rather fantastic canvas which looks almost like the colourings of it's like a tiger, but in pink, blue, and red. What about that one?
This is the image that people will see around town on the poster. It's a painting called Red with Red, and it's a relatively recent painting, just with three colours, a blue and two reds, one a pink and an orange on either side of red. And this is a painting where Bridget was really exploring how colours which are very close to each other, both in tone and in hue, will play off against each other. And it's a wonderfully exuberant painting. I think people have been used to thinking of Bridget Riley's work being quite tight in its nature. But during late 1990s, she wanted to get curves back into her work, and also to broaden out the colour into wide planes. And she realised that the combination of verticals and diagonals and curves could give her the spatial twists and turnings that she'd been trying to achieve earlier in paintings which I suppose, had a far more descriptive element about it, where curves were really being drawn. Here, the curves are implied and happen with great economy. But moving on with the exhibition, which we haven't hung chronologically, we come to one of these first Egyptian works, where you have this very limited set of colours which had served the Egyptians for those 3,000 years. There's a print here hanging, which is one of a pair of prints which she did, where she was exploring the very, very different qualities that you can get with the same set of colours if you combine them in different ways. Mm-hmm. And this one is called Silvered, and it really, if you look at it from a distance, colours fuse into a sort of wonderful misty grey. The other print is a far more radiant one. It suggests the warmth and the light of the Mediterranean or Egypt, whereas this one is far more to do with the light of northern climes. And Bridget has been very conscious about the different qualities of light, and actually, while she's based in London as an artist, she also, for many years, has worked in the south of France, and also has a studio in Cornwall, where the light is far more brilliant than we're used to in this part of the world. And just moving on from the beginning of the exhibition, we come into a room where we're looking at one wall, where on the left we have a painting of vertical stripes using the Egyptian colours, using that limited palette. But then, just looking to the right, we see how Bridget Riley extends that palette, starts to work with variations. So the first thing we notice, actually, is the black and white has dropped out of the painting. I think black was being used very much to create rhythm in the paintings, and the white to allow air to come into them. But she found she was relying on them too much, and so these fell out, and as those fell out, so more colours crept into these paintings. So the one on the right is a wider palette, and you see how she's bringing together pinks and oranges, which are very close to each other, then strikingly contrasted with greens and blues. So there are rhythms set up, and spaces, shallow spaces being created, undulate through the painting. So your eye is always weaving in and out of these colours.
A new arts venue in Cambridge needs to find new ways to attract vital funding if it's going to further realise an expansion dream and cultivate new talent. Cambridge Arts Salon opened in early September and has an art exhibition space for a stable of 20 artists in Cromwell Road. But member artist Diane Probst says it currently lacks the cash to move forwards and isn't being properly supported in that aim by the City Council, and it's because the location is discriminated against for not being central enough to attract the public in. Diane, a professional fine art painter, says it's now down to the artists to use their creative wits to prove themselves in the community and attract the support so that they can compete with the more conservative venues in the city centre. She shared a few thoughts.
Originally, it came about through Positive World Studios, an organisation run mostly by the artists involved, with Ruthie Collins being the main power behind it. We were on the Newmarket Road. The building we were occupying was near derelict. We were there with the City Life organisation. When planning permission was passed for a new building there, we were given our marching orders, and Ruthie happened to have found out that there was this space going free. She negotiated and we moved in here.
Just so that our listeners know, this is actually in the old Graham Jenkins motorcycle shop on Cromwell Road, which many people may know about from the past if you're wondering where the art space is. What was the concept behind how you were going to use this space? What was the aim of it?
The aim was always to have a public space at the front that was good, not just for public access for the artists to the public, but also so that everyone can come in from the outside. We want to be an inclusive community space, and so it's possible to hire out the front of the gallery, and then at the back and upstairs there are individual rooms and individual artist spaces.
There's quite a range of artistic activity going on here. Can you tell me a little bit about the spectrum of things that are happening in this fantastic little spot you found here?
We have people who attempt photorealism in fine art. We have abstract painting. We have millinery. We have ceramics, bag makers, we have print makers, we have all sorts of people in 2D and 3D. We have a sculptor working in the same room I do. It's fantastic. We get to talk about things that are not our main focus, which is always good for broadening the mind.
Now, your paintings here are things like, I see that you've got a portrait of Stephen Fry. Is that one of yours?
I know, no, it's Kerry Littletile. Kerry is very good at portraits in acrylic. She puts the colour on exactly where it should be. It's absolutely fantastic. And she's capable of drawing out a particular face as well as a personality. There's a physical element of caricature there, but I think that it brings in the personality a lot more successfully than a caricature would.
And what about your paintings? Which ones are yours here?
I have an oil painting of stuff that I put onto my palette.
Yep.
My palette is a very reflective surface there, and so I was working with the reflections. I've got two charcoals hanging up here, which are a random selection of mountains that I made up, and a study piece that I was doing for the oil painting itself. I've just taken a lot of my stuff to be photographed before I have it framed.
Fantastic.
I started painting a bit over a year ago. So I have very little access to historical data. I simply don't know what it was like. As far as I can work out, there are more supportive councils elsewhere, but the council is not actually stopping artists from doing what they want to. It's just that it can be difficult to get funding, for example.
What's it done for you personally as an artist to be part of a project like this?
It's meant that I could paint. I would not have been able to develop as an artist. I would not have been able to paint simply as an artist. I would have been in my kitchen with two small children around me. So it's fantastic that I have a space in which to work, and that I have the belief that I should have a space in which to work, because it took me quite a while to realise that it belonged to me.
If you have a talent for music with a touch of nostalgia, you might find you're suddenly in demand in Cambridge. Cambridge Museum of Technology is appealing for volunteer choirs, singers and buskers who can fill the void of the museum on Sunday, October the 30th and create a bit of atmosphere. The aim is to bring alive the old Victorian pumping station in Cheddar's Lane with songs of industrial Britain from the viewpoint of workers, with themes of rivers and steam particularly, but a shanty or two will also be welcome. Organiser Keith Jordan of the Abbey Action Project explains. First of all, Keith, tell me what the Abbey Action is exactly.
Well, it's a community project that started about 12 years ago, which is based around what was the old Abbey area, which is what people refer to as East Barnwell. But since the boundary changes took place in 2004, it took in the riverside area as well, so where we are now standing.
Right, okay. Now, at the moment, we're in the most fantastic old... It's the Museum of Technology, which is down by the river near Elizabeth Way Bridge. And it's a fantastic old Victorian sewerage pumping station. The likes I've never seen before, and having never visited it before, I had absolutely no idea it was here, and it's fantastically atmospheric. Can you tell me a little bit about how this amazing building came to be and why it's still up and running as an operational museum with a huge pump in it?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a real hidden gem of Cambridge, which is on the more the outskirts of Cambridge. And in its time, in fact, there's an old photo, probably about 100 years ago, of when the pumping station, which basically pumps all the sewage that was previously going into the river, Cam, and polluting it, it got pumped all the way up to Milton, where there was the earliest sewage works. And this lovely old photo, it's probably about 100 years old, shows what is now the museum, because it's obviously what we see today is a huge chimney which dominates most of Cambridge. You can see it from miles around. And it's standing along what is Riverside with virtually nothing else around. You can see the other side to Chesterton is just trees and meadows. And all there is at the moment is just the pumping works. Although this area was also, there was also lots of other industry. There was brickworks, a foundry, a gasworks just down River Lane. So this was the real industrial heartland of Cambridge.
But stepping in here, it's like going back in time to the Victorian era and the age of steam, because you have these amazing machines, which we're standing in the pumping room at the moment. And it's absolutely huge steel wheels. They've all been polished up beautifully in brass. Quite fascinating to look at them. And is it quite a feat to actually keep them going and keep them in this condition?
Well, I mean, as you say, they're like two great big static steam trains. So that means the same principle, and these go back to about 1895 or so, when the pumping station was first built and got going. So obviously it does take a lot of volunteer time, because this museum is primarily run by volunteers. So there's a lot of people who come in and tinker with bits of machinery, keep them lubricated, and make bits when they're needed, and it's a constant job. But it, they keep it highly polished and working, as good as it did 100 years ago.
Now, I've just been having a route around through some of the rooms here. There's wonderful kind of coal sheds, there's tunnels to go into, there's all sorts of bits of equipment, there's machines, there's things from time past, an awful lot of content in this museum. And it isn't arranged incredibly neatly like the Fitzwilliam Museum. It's kind of all over the place, and that gives it a kind of depth, and you feel a little bit oily moving around it, don't you?
Yeah, I think that's what's great about it. In some ways, it isn't all so spick and span, because that would take away sort of the atmosphere and sort of imagining what it was like when it was all up and running. When it was basically, it would have been probably a dirty, grimy place, noisy, steam. It ran 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Right, now we've stepped back in time into the void in the main room in the museum. You are engaged in a project to fill this void with music, aren't you?
The idea came from the fact that we've organised a couple of events, so I'm in a community singing group as well, and we've sung in some old buildings like the Leper Chapel, which is just down the road, which is the oldest complete building in Cambridge, where we sang that during the Stourbridge Fair, and we also did a bit of singing at the Cellar Exchequer, which is just down the other way along Riverside, which is the remaining part of Barnwell Priory. So it felt like there was one building, historic building, that was missing, and in some ways much younger, but it seems like a wonderful space is around to fill it with music, and especially if it relates to the industrial times when these steam engines were pumping away, and the daily lives of working people when life was very hard, people worked long hours.
Any musicians listening can probably hear the acoustics in this room, which is quite fantastic. So what do people do if they want to get involved and they want to become step back in time and create some music in here?
Well, they basically need to just contact me, and I'll give you my contact detail later, and say, do they want to come, and if so, what type of music do they play? And I'm especially interested in people who have got songs or something in their repertoire which relates to industrial songs, be like Ewan McColl, Dirty Old Town, there's another one, Cannily Cannily, or even ones relating to the river, because obviously this played a huge part of cleaning up the river. And if you think the river played a huge part in trade in Cambridge, it was like the A14, A1 of its time, bringing trade down. So there could even be, barges and ships came down the River Cam from the River Ouse up from King's Lynn. So it's a case of, and there might be sea shanties, inland sea shanties, which might be relevant as well.
I'm sure there's lots of people who can rustle up a shanty here and there. Will other people be welcome to come join in or sing? Or?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's if there's participation as well. And so your people are free to wander around the museum, look at the exhibits. There'll be a few working exhibits, the gas pump engines be working, but then come and listen to people busking at different places around the building. And
Sunday, it's happening on Sunday the 30th of October. What time will it kick off?
Well, the museum is actually open on both days as well, but the singing event is on the Sunday, but both days the museum is open from 11 till 5 p.m. So during that time, we hope to have music at different times and different places.
Great place to bring the family, because there's lots of really wow things for children to see here, isn't there? I mean, if you're interested in machines, this is a paradise, really, isn't it?
And there's usually some hand pumps which children can work, which are pumping water, and which is great fun.
Yeah.
By the people of Cambridge. This is Cambridge 105.
Ceramics and figurative paintings with a narrative thread are paired up in a new joint exhibition just opened at Cambridge Contemporary Arts in Trinity Street. Local ceramics artist and sculptor Helen Martino is juxtaposed strikingly with acclaimed figurative painter Ian McWhinney in a new show in which each item depicting a landscape has a tale to tell behind it. McWhinney's work, inspired by recent trips to New York and Italy, explore the moods created by the relationship people have with their surroundings, which some commented were a little haunting and perhaps sombre, but also strangely compelling and colourful. Helen Martino's work, in contrast, shows scenes from picnics, boats and journeys, all of which have a local story woven in. She introduces the work. Helen, the dappled shade, is that kind of looking into a sort of subconscious memory or something like that?
No, it's just, well, I suppose in a way it is, in that I love being under the dappled shade, and yeah. We picnic a lot as a family, and that's where I feel the happiest, when there's dappling and things. Mm. And that was a walk I went on in that path across from the Backs to St John's.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
And I was looking at also at Happy Times, which is a print over there. Is that looking back into happy memories, or because it has a very sort of relaxed and happy feeling to it?
Yeah, it's just playful.
So playful.
Yeah, yeah. I'm very much interested in birds,
but
not the species, but just the way they are together.
Yeah.
And the fragility of the birds compared to the woman lounging around, I thought was a nice contrast.
Now, can you tell me a bit about the more recent work that you've done and what's on display here? What have you tried to do with this exhibition?
I started off by thinking about boats and the sea and the way people are in boats together, whether it's the weather that influences whether they're happy or whether they're serious, whether they're trying to get somewhere or whether they're having pleasure. And then that, they're my newest ones, really. And then again, picnics. And I've been making over the summer, so there's been a lot of nice days out with the family and with friends. They evolve into sculptures.
So I noticed that you have things that look like incomplete things. Golden Autumn, a ceramic, which looks like fragments of something.
Right, maybe that's because of the way it's made, in that with porcelain and making, I've layered it up with different techniques. So you get the autumn bit, and yet beyond it, you get the wintry feel of the next season coming through. So it was a sort of passing of time. And again, trees and shade and light.
Yeah. Now this exhibition is partnered with Ian McWhinney. Why was that? Why does his work go alongside?
Because he's also involved with narrative and the intimacy of people and the way they are together.
Can you tell me what his paintings do for you? Because obviously he's not here this evening.
No.
But they're very interesting images. They look slightly as though they may have come from America. Are they?
Oh, no. Really? No, he's Scottish.
Scottish, yeah.
And he used to be a ceramics person.
Yeah.
I think he's travelled in America and Italy and things. And my feeling is that they have a sort of haunting quality. That's like they've come from the past.
That's what I think. It looks like something that could have come from Chicago in the past. That's what I kind of got.
Right, we thought
that
Italian mafia.
Slightly haunting, not necessarily a happy time, but definitely an interesting time. And I haven't seen anything like that at all before. They do make very striking images because they're very bold, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
A good contrast with my work, which is similar because it has a narrative, but very different quality. In that his are strong and mine are a bit more frivolous.
And lastly, Flack magazine has just hit the streets. It's a magazine for the homeless, designed to keep people off the street and doing creative and productive things with their lives. Creative director Kirstine Lavers and contributor Jude Evans, whose photo is on the front page of the new glossy edition, gave an update on the project, which is now up and running.
So the great thing about Flack is that it's, you can do as little or as much as you feel comfortable with doing. You know, it, on one day you could come in and you're having a bad day and all you can really do is maybe contribute to a decision about, you know, on the editorial. Or I've been asked to write articles and I was even writing a regular column charting the progress of my life over the since late last year when I got my first tenancy. It's almost like getting back into work.
Great. Kirsten, can you tell me a little bit about how the project has moved on? Because last time I saw it, it was before the magazine actually came out. Mm-hmm. I spoke to Toby Peters mm-hmm. about the Pinhole Camera project, which was, that exhibition was a huge success.
Yep.
What's now happened since then? FLAC is now up and running for the first time, isn't it?
That's right, yes. At that stage, we were producing pilot magazines, just 500 copies a month for the homeless community, just to get into the swing of how you, the work cycle, in a way, of producing a monthly magazine. So since then, we've moved from a tiny little black hole of Kolkata of an office to a wonderful spacious space at City Life House at Sturton Street. And then we've scaled up to prepare ourselves to launch our full 32-page glossy monthly magazine, which we launched last week on Tuesday the 27th.
Can you tell me a little bit about the content of this magazine? Because it seems to be full of interesting things leafing through it.
Yeah, it's great. I'm very pleased with it. Well, this month's issue includes a fantastic fashion shoot involving five homeless women as models that was that we collaborated with John Lewis Cambridge on. There is poetry, there's a recipe, there's a really quirky, fantastically fiendish crossword. We have a review of Alexander Master's latest book, Genius in the Basement, by, again, and all the articles, I must stress, are written by our homeless contributors. Gosh, what else have we got?
What are the hurdles coming up for you in terms of the development of the project over the next few months?
The next challenge now is, we know we've got a great product, we've got fantastic feedback from people, so now we need to get it out there. And I'd really encourage anybody, if you're keen to get your hands on it, the best thing you can do to help us is go to your newsagents and say, please will you stock FLAC magazine, because I want to buy it from you.
It's a very smart looking magazine. Mm. It'll go alongside presumably Explorer and Agenda and all the other Cambridge magazines.
Absolutely. I mean, we like to think that we're quite different from Agenda and Explorer, because we're very light on adverts. And we really do work hard to provide comprehensive what's on listings of things to do and get involved with in Cambridge.
Now, for people who do get involved in this, there's quite a scope of activities that you can get involved in, isn't there? Because it's photography, it's journalism,
absolutely,
it's making films and things like that.
Yeah.
I saw Toby Peters there making a video film of,
yeah,
something that he's been doing.
Yeah, no, we've got a lot of filmmaking activity going on. We've got our own YouTube channel, FLAC Cambridge. Mm. There's lots of ways of getting involved with a magazine. You don't necessarily have to be a writer or an artist. There are lots of business-related tasks in terms of distribution, marketing, sales, advertising, design. So it's a great, the magazine at the centre of FLAC is a great way of involving people at whatever level they're ready to get involved and with whatever interest they have.
Now, if anybody wants to support this project, how do they go about doing that?
Oh, well, you can firstly go and ask your newsagents to stock it. You might consider subscribing to FLAC magazine online, so you get your copy in the post at the beginning of every month. We're also welcome volunteers who feel they've got skills or time to offer. And what other ways could people get involved? I think those are three good ways to start with. And immediately you could vote for us on the NatWest Community Force website, because we've been shortlisted for a NatWest Community Force award, and we need as many votes as we can get. So,
great.
You know, that's a 2-minute way to support us if you like the idea of what we're doing.
That's all we have time for this week on Arts Roundup at Cambridge 105 FM. I'm Simon Burton, and I hope you enjoyed the hour.